beautiful Abbey Church in Bath, in England, has a great carved stone arch above the front doors. And carved into the arch is a ladder. And climbing up the ladder are angels, literally their hands and feet holding the rungs of the ladder. Sadly, most of the angels are without heads. We were told by our guide that Cromwell's soldiers used the angels' heads as target practice during the English Civil War. Sounds unbelievable. How horrible. How could anyone destroy something so beautiful as angels? But if you know a little bit about history, or if you look at our world today, you might be able to understand how Oliver Cromwell's soldiers might have felt. When all the wealth and power in a nation were held by a king and a few lords and bishops, those angels represented injustice. While their families slaved away just to eat, bishops and lords and kings lived in luxury, playing and spending money as if it were water. It's those angels depicted on the arches of the Bath Abbey that are from the story we heard about Jacob's dream. It's that story they're depicting. And in that story, the angels are a wonderful symbol, sign to Jacob. He has this incredible dream that the angels are ascending and descending, and he hears God tell him that the plans that he has are the right plans and that he should go forward and do what he's planning to do and that God will be with him. And this is such an incredible dream that Jacob takes the stone that was his pillow and sets it up like an altar, pouring oil on it, calling it a holy place as it is still today. That acknowledgement that God blessed him and his plans. But angels have a whole different reputation in the parable we heard today. It's not the image we get of angels at Christmas or good get well cards. These are the angels that are taking the evil and the evil doers at the end of the age and throwing them into the fiery furnace and burning them up. And certainly in old pictures of angels, you see Michael the Archangel with a sword. There's a power. But that parable is so clearly delineated between good and evil that it makes me uncomfortable. It's almost tempting to just disregard the parable because we know the kind of things that have come out of reading and interpreting that parable. That idea that some people know who are the weeds and who are the wheat, and they're going to tell us who they are, and they're going to punish and even kill now those that don't make the grade. So it's tempting to get away, just not listen to that parable. We could go the other direction and just say, it's a story. There isn't really good and evil. It's just choices that we make, and there's consequences. Become very utilitarian about it. We could just dismiss the parable that way. And it could have ended there, I suppose, just kind of putting it aside, except that my family and I have been doing a Harry Potter marathon this week. We watched every movie, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then watched the final movie in the theater. So my whole week has been filled with images of good and evil, angels and demons. But in all those movies and all that drama, there's one line that is still sitting with me, and it comes from the first movie. The first time that Harry Potter, the hero, encounters Voldemort, the epitome of evil, Voldemort is trying to get him to give him the Sorcerer's Stone or the Philosopher's Stone that he has. And Voldemort says to Harry, "There is no good or evil. There is only power. Join me, and that, I think, is the ultimate evil. To claim that there is no good or evil is even more dangerous than anything. So I feel like I got to look at that parable again. And as Brian reminded us last week, we should look at the behavior of this farmer, this landowner. He's really not very capable. Because this one, first of all, sometimes I wonder if he's just making an excuse. He knows he didn't buy the right kind of wheat. And so he just says, oh, an enemy planted weeds. But really, he didn't really plant the best seed. Maybe that's it. But also, any of you who are gardeners know that you really can't leave weeds just mixed in with wheat because the weeds are stronger. They take over the garden. But this gardener is patient. He insists on not pulling up the weeds until the harvest. So to those who want to read this parable as an opportunity or an invitation to be judgmental are not reading the parable. Jesus says to wait. Maybe we don't know the difference between what's weed and what's wheat. Maybe we don't know that in some environments something is a weed, but in another environment it's a very useful, helpful, or beautiful plant. Maybe we just have to suspend our judgment and leave it to God. And I think it's helpful not to look at the parable just about the world, but rather to take it more personally. When I hear this parable, it makes sense to me that I was created by God with both weed and wheat in me. And I know that the experiences of my life have made one or the other flourish and grow more at different times. The choices I make determine how much weed and how much wheat grow in my day or in my week. And so it's helpful for me to think that God is going to let those experiences and those choices grow in me together. And that those experiences and choices begin to thin out and select what is right and good. And actually, then it almost seems like a good idea to come at the end of the age and know that God is going to burn away all the yucky stuff. And what's going to be left inside is this wonderful, healthy, glorious wheat that shines like the sun, as it says. There is no good or evil, only power. Dangerous, dangerous idea. There is both wheat and weed in every person, and it is not for us to judge. Much more loving and much more right.